right? And now all of a sudden that six becomes eight, and whatever stress the family may have had where they can make it through six now has to go another two. Every little decision that you're being very articulate about, every little decision people make along the line affects everybody. And I don't know that unless you take the time to look at it, you don't even sort of realize that. I mean, why would you? Everybody else has their own life, right? Because you're actually into this. You know what? Could you generalize this? Then I'll let John ask some questions. My cousin came back from NAM, and he was a mess because, you know, he was in a group, and there were 35 people, and he was one of five that got out. Everybody else got blown up kind of thing. There's that kind of stuff. There's stress where people kill people, but they don't really like that. There's people that see a bunch of dead bodies. There's people that are in airplanes that do stuff. And there's other people when they get home, there's no family, there's no friends. There's got to be how many different kinds of stress? I mean, it's not all the same, is it?
No, there's many different types of stress. I mean, I see it at Hines more so than I have at Lovell, because Hines has so many veterans. I mean, there's still some World War II veterans there. There are Korean veterans. There are Vietnam veterans, Iraq, Afghanistan. And the trauma on every single one of them is just so different, and each person handles it a little differently. But so many of them are really ill. Cancer, Parkinson's disease. I mean, I can't tell you how many of them have so many amputees. And then a lot of the Iraq and Afghanistan's are, their major of them are paralyzed because of some sort of injury, and a lot of them have amputees. But some of them, you know, I spend time, if they want to talk, they will talk. I ask them questions. Sometimes they enjoy talking about it. There was one gentleman there who has left now. He went to Quincy, to a veteran's home. He was at Hines, but he was a medic in Vietnam, and he wrote a book about his days being a medic. And it's just amazing. I really love reading history, because when these medical officers, or even, you know, generals or people that have been in war, write their thoughts down and put it in on paper and what they've survived. Oh my gosh. I mean, every single person in this country should just read a military book and find out the traumas of what war does and how these people have survived and how did they survive, you know, and why they survived. But, you know, this gentleman's Robert, and I asked him about it. I said, how do you deal with this? He goes, I write. He goes, it really helps me. And he's a really good writer. The book is really good. And then, you know, there's General Mukayama, who was a general in Vietnam. His book, Faith, Family, and the Flag, the same thing. He wrote about Vietnam. You know, he's Japanese. And then, you know, what they did to World War II with the Japanese, but he went and fought for our country. So everyone has a story, and it's just a matter of, you know, do you want to know about it? Most people, if you don't talk to people, how are you going to know about anything? How are you going to know about who they are, what they're all about?
Well, it's easy. You don't want to know.
No. Exactly. Most people don't want to know. They don't care. But I find it so fascinating, these men, how they survived. I mean, one gentleman from Vietnam, he's just finding out that he's going to lose his leg because of diabetes, and his body's breaking down. And he started talking to me about what was going on in Vietnam and what he had. It was a gunner. And then he just broke down and just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And the only thing I could do was just hug him. I just didn't know what else to do but hug him. And, you know, they're just lonely.
That's my next question before I turn it over to Jen here. Is the, if you're not the Chicago area, I mean, I keep throwing out statistics, Ty, because I'm trying to add to what you're saying, and that in the Afghanistan situation, only like 11% of the people came from big cities. It's all a small town. The mechanics group from Kent, Ohio would go over there or something. There's some of that in Chicago, but not very much. And so when somebody comes back, you know, it's kind of not like World War II, where everybody just all went to the VFW together. Not that they didn't have problems, they did. Basically, there's a bunch of guys, they all went and drank themselves silly about it, right? Which is really kind of what happened. But if you come back from somewhere, you're in Chicago, where do you get a peer group? There's nobody here. I mean, I won't say nobody. Where do you find a peer group that was there with you? I mean, in so many small towns in downstate Illinois, maybe you do, but here, is it, I mean, one of the guys I knew in my neighborhood, he came back from Nam. Well, all the girls he dated were already married to somebody else. His family, I think his family died, except for his sister, and he just was a lost soul. I mean, how much of it is just that versus the war stuff?
That is a lot of it, too. And, you know, this is where organizations, you know, the American Legions and the Sons of Legions, and, you know, some of these guys have found family with these, you know, older veterans, and they're part of an organization. And everyone needs to belong to something, somewhere. And so, you know, that's where some of the social worker for mental illness, they have to be part of an organization. They need to belong. They need to have a family. And if they don't have a family to help them, you know, they always encourage different organizations. And there's a lot of them. You know what? And I will work at finding all these different organizations that's like in the state of Illinois where if you want to really find a family that you can, you know, hang in and be welcomed, you can certainly belong. We're always open. Anybody can you know, come into the Friends of Fisher House. I have a lot of veterans on the board. You know, that's one of the things that we try to do, too. We try to reach out, outreach for different organizations. And there's an organization about helping vets to prevent suicide, because that's a couple veterans on our board have had friends that have committed suicide. So it's very close and dear to them. So we work on that. But I think part of it is you have to want to find a place too. If you don't, then nobody's going to come knocking on your door, I don't think. But you really have to kind of...
Diane, these suicides are just people, I mean, again, I'm not propping you up here, but most gun violence, gun deaths are what, older white guys blowing themselves away?
Yes.
It's scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, Jim's nephew is the youngest sergeant major at Clarksville, Tennessee, and he was part of the 101st, and he spent a lot of time in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he had two of his buddies commit suicide, and it destroyed him. He is a changed man now, and I've noticed this about him, and I've had conversations with him to try to...
Did he have any clue that these guys were that far? Do you have any hint?
I think they just hold back. They don't talk to anybody. And one day you just find out that they've, you know, destroyed themselves. So it's just, you gotta just start talking. You gotta start talking to people.
Jan, go ahead. I'm sure you're busting with questions.
Diane, I've been wondering. I've been struck recently in doing family research and the stuff that's become available on Ancestry.com and other sites about, you know, military hospitals, convalescent hospitals, working farms, you know, where veterans were often, you know, hospitalized short-term, long-term. But it seems like there's been a shrinkage of facilities like that, at least in Illinois, over, say, the last century or so. And I'm wondering if you see, is there generally like a consolidation effort by the VA when it comes to facilities and locating them and expanding them and closing the ones that are smaller and more expensive to operate? Is the movement towards a shrinking number of places available to veterans and a geographic concentration of the surviving ones. This would seem like one of the biggest reasons why there should be something like Fisher House, because people are not near convalescent facilities for veterans, at least as near as they were, say, maybe in the years after the Civil War or after World War One, and that there's fewer of these facilities, and the VA has been forced to kind of close ranks and shut a lot of facilities and expand the ones that survived. Is that the impression you have too? Or?
Well, I don't know about closing any facilities or consolidating, but I do know of the need. A friend of mine's father is a Vietnam vet, and he's trying to get him, there's a veteran's home in Chicago on Montrose, and they're trying to get him in because his mother died and his dad needs care, and there's a 5-year waiting list to get him in there, and I find this unacceptable. So I'm trying to see if I can't get him in to the extended care unit at Hines, because, and I'm trying to find out more research about the extended care at Hines, because I see it, there's empty rooms. There's two floors of extended care, which is kind of like, for better lack of words, it's like the nursing home for veterans at Hines. They, you know, they're there. Some come and then they go home, but most of them are there permanently because that is their resident. And I see empty rooms, and I'm trying to figure out why they can't get in to fill those rooms. But it might be a staffing issue.
It's totally a staffing issue. By the way, I have a couple of texts here. Diane is terrific, and one of the guys is a veteran. He said Fisher House is very useful. So there you go.
Yay! Thank you.
You brought up the question that I was going to ask. When you say somebody went to Quincy, now Quincy's state run, what is the interplay there? My stepfather, after being in several nursing homes that were pretty awful, was, he wasn't the best patient. Let's put it that way, Diane. John knows what I'm talking about. He was not the best patient. Well, it took us 6 months minimum, maybe 9 months, to get him in Manteno, which is the close one here. And when we got him in down there, the place is, the people are spectacular. Absolutely spectacular. And first thing when I went down there, and they had, you know, they got the, whatever, the restaurant, they got the little bank, they got everything. I'm walking along, just like you, I go, wait a minute, this place is half full. Why is there the staffing? There's a certain amount of staff they need per person. They I don't even think it was half full. It might have been 40% full. But that's all state. Now, how does somebody get kicked from the veterans is federal, and then the Manteno and Quincy, and there's another one in Western Illinois. There's three of them, and I'm making me wonder, the one you're talking about in Montrose, is that state or federal? They don't have, but the people down there, maybe because it was Kankakee, the nurses and people are nicest people on earth, and it's, you learn a hell of a lot, Diane, about families. When they drop people off, they make everybody sign all these, you know, papers. I go, my stepfather, I go, how the hell did you get him to sign that stuff? The guy says, because you and your brother are very unusual. And I go, well, I guess I know that. He goes, no, seriously. He goes. Most people, the last time they see their dad is they drop them off. And one thing we always ask is the phone number of the undertaker, because that's the next call we make. And it's pretty scary.
It's really scary. It's a sad reality of it. And I see the same thing at Hines. You know, I do not see very many people coming in to visit. The only time I see families coming in to visit is when they know that they're in hospice and their days are limited. You know, that is when I will see some families around. And then a lot of times, if those families are really far away, they stay at Fisher House until that loved one has passed. So that's, you know, that's part of what we do. But the housing in Illinois is a state. The only federal facilities are the Captain James Level Federal Healthcare Facility and Hines VA. Manteno, Quincy, and Montrose are state-run homes, And I think you both know that the state of Illinois has no money. We are not going to be getting our grant this year for Fisher House. We didn't get it last year. So I'll try the first quarter of 2026 and see if there's anything, but I don't see it looking promising for
us. The amount of help that the Mantino groups and gets from the people in like Kankakee County or whatever it is, we're talking Sox games, we're talking stuff. There's guys, if you can get up and go, there's stuff for people to do a lot, and it's all volunteer.
Absolutely. It's all volunteer. Yeah. And kind of the same way with us at Fisher House, you know, our support comes from individuals and some businesses we get a lot of support from the American Legions throughout the state. And I was just in Springfield with the WIM Women's Group, which is a division of the Elks. The women created this over 30 years ago because the Elks didn't let the women join, so they created their own organization. And these women they're just so wonderful. And they volunteer at all these Mantino and Quincy and Kankakee and down in Lincoln and help support the local veterans.
Where do the women vet? I mean, is it obviously you must have women veterans there too? I mean, what is? I was always stunned by the amount of women that.
It's probably 5% of the women that are at the hospitals. There's not that many, but there are women, and you're right, there are women veterans. But right now, it's about maybe 5%.
What are the nurses that treated all these guys in all these wars? They got to be just as messed up. Where do they go? They don't get anything anywhere, do they?
Well, they can get their treatment at Hines or.
But I mean, a lot of them were not really in the Army. They were in the WAC sort of waves. I mean, those.
But they're still they're considered military.
Okay, but they
veterans, and they get part of their treatment. They get certain treatments through the VA hospitals, whatever they need. And if they're serious, you know, if there's heart issues or diabetes or cancer, they're in Hines VA hospital or level.
But they were not covered by way back in the day, the GI Bill and stuff.
No, and I don't really know. I can't answer to that, Tom. But, you know, now I do see women in the hospital and getting treatment. So that's a good thing.
There were, I always kind of wander off on stupid stuff, but I found out my uncle got killed in World War II. And some lady who was in Southside, she's probably dead by now, I don't know, but somehow tracked down his Purple Heart and contacted my brother, and she sent me all the newspaper articles and stuff about him, you know, coming home and getting buried. Well, he wasn't buried till 1948. And I'm thinking, he died in 1945. And Lou, who's on the show, and he's a veteran with the Air Force Academy, said what they did was, he died taking a bridge between France and Germany, right? So they throw all the bodies into a mass grave. And they yank one of the dog tags, they leave the one on. So at the end of the war, it was almost all women, and maybe the guys dug the hole. They went and redug the holes and matched the bodies up. Can you imagine that job? And then they would notify the family. They'd say, okay, we'll get the body to, I won't say O'Hare, probably came by train somewhere, if you want to bury him there, otherwise we'll bury him here. And none of those women were involved in the GI Bill. I wonder if they ever got. I got to believe there was a few head cases there, don't you think?
Yeah.
What a job.
Sure. Yeah, it's got to be so horrible.
I mean, it's just every place you turn. I mean, every time you turn a corner in one of these places, there's another story. There has to be.
Oh, it's story after story after story, and. You know, for any family member that has a veteran that's still surviving World War II, Korea, Vietnam, you know, I really encourage all of them to start talking about their stories and start writing them down just to have information and know about, you know, your family history and what they've gone through. because it really is a very fascinating stories of all of these men and women that put their lives on the line. And I always say this when I'm making a presentation for Fisher House, you know, Zachary Fisher's vision was to help military families after World War II. And, you know, his desire to make a difference in the world has made it to fruition in 35 states, two countries, Germany and England, and 100 Fisher Houses, and they're not stopping. They're going to keep going because no matter what happens, I mean, these gentlemen that, you know, Iraq, Iran, even part of Vietnam, they're going to be aging and they're going to need care. So they want to be able to have houses for these families and people that need it. But as Ken Fisher, who is the executive officer of Fisher House out of Bethesda, Maryland, he says, one of the nation's greatest treasures is our military.
Yeah, we don't treat it like such. John, ask John a couple questions and we'll let her go. What? Hey, I'll bet he never thought that 75 years later he'd still need him.
I guess. I don't know.
World War One was the war to end all wars, right?
Well, this was World War II, right? Yeah. But so he saw, you know, the military coming back from World War II, and that was just, you know, distraught families and needing care. And, you know, it's kind of this situation where I met a woman at Hines, and her husband was in intensive care, and we started talking. She was pretty distraught. And we started talking and finding out that she didn't know where she was going to stay. And I said, no, you can stay at Fisher House. And I said, where do you live? So in order to stay at a Fisher House, you need to be at least 50 miles away. Anyone closer than 50 miles is really not eligible. But what we did, because she didn't know how she didn't want to leave her husband and she didn't want to have to drive back at night, we put her up in a hotel. A local hotel, and we did it for a week. So she was there for a week, and then so basically, we always say no one is turned away. The three things that help heal anyone going through a crisis is faith, family, and a physician. So a medication. So that's kind of our motto for Fisher Health.
John, if you have anything, and then we'll let Di go, and Di, make sure you. Listen in on Wednesday, or we'll send it to you to see what Dr. Blade has to say, Dr. Mark Johnson, and then we're trying to find a day where you and Kenny can get on together, because I know he wants to talk to you because of the money they brought up there. They might be, maybe we want to do something else here like that.
Yeah. Well, I'd be glad to give you guys a tour of Hines or Lovell anytime you want. So
I'm going to take you up on that.
Okay.
I'll drag John with. I'll have to go get him. You know, he'll probably be rearranging his sock drawer, but I'll drag him out. John, you have a question or two before she goes?
Diane, you know, it seems that you know Vietnam was a kind of watershed in you know people's and families' attitudes towards you know war and giving up so much for apparently so little in terms of defense or national objectives or people pulling together the way they did formerly in wars. And do you think that perception that veterans or veterans' families have now has changed even since Vietnam about the kind of engagements that have resulted in injuries or accidents and the kind of you know attitude that people have about why their family member had to go and why things were managed this way? Is there a different attitude about the way that the government handles its engagements, and is there more like skepticism or suspicion since Vietnam among veterans and their families?
Well, I think that there's probably some veterans and families that are still kind of angry about the whole situation, but I do see a shift in helping veterans. And supporting veterans and thanking veterans and realizing what a horrible, horrible reaction that the country did to these military men. They just did their job, what the government asked them to do. I don't care what anybody's persuasion is on, you know, left or right, but they were asked to do a job, and that's what they did. And to be treated the way they did, what happened to them when they came back was just unconscionable, because that they didn't ask for that. They were in the military. They did what the country said. And I think now that...
Some of those guys got spit upon when they get back in the airport.
Sorry?
Some of those guys got spit upon coming back through the airport.
I know. It's just horrible. So, you know, it has changed. And I think that's where some people feel a little guilty, maybe, and that so they're now trying to do more things for helping the veterans, which is, you know, a great positive attitude. And also, this government is very, very positive and supportive of military. So it kind of has shifted a little bit. But, you know, whatever. A person that goes into the military, I'm not sure why they're doing that. I really, you know, I might start doing some research and finding out some of these young kids up in Great Lakes Naval Base, because Great Lakes Naval Base is the largest training ground in the country. That's where they all go to get trained and getting into, you know, the service. So I think I'm gonna do some little research and find out just why are these, you know, people going into the military. I do know that one aspect of it is that they get a free education. I mean, a lot of these, you know, people are going in, learning, getting, you know, masters and getting some of them going in for PhDs because they're getting their education paid for. So that's a good thing.
Well, is there a difference when I used to, they're not many of them around anymore, but my extended family's in Columbus. Yeah. And I used to go down there once in a while. And, you know, of course, I'm up early, I'm reading the Sunday paper. Even in the Afghanistan situation, every Sunday there's this group from a town around Columbus. It's kind of a way of life in some of these areas. You don't see it in Chicago, but in some areas it's a way of life for the families. Always been part of the, you know, something Ohio mechanics corps of the reserves or something, where you go in and you become you like never get called up, or you normally don't. And all of a sudden, in Afghanistan and Iraq, all these guys are being called up, and some of the bombs are going off behind the lines, so 8 or 10 people in a small town are getting blasted when they're not even really infantry, whatever even that term means anything anymore.
Yeah,
but people are constantly coming and going in these smaller towns, and everybody's part of the, you know, what's the group out at Ford City, John? They're the anti-tank group or something out of,
yeah,
but it's all over in these smaller areas and cities. You just never hear about it. I mean, it's not like there's nobody here involved, but I gotta believe that maybe the support in some of the smaller towns is better than the city. It's just a suspicion. I don't know.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The small town USA, that is where all of our military comes from. I mean, if you look at kind of the country and you take a U, you go from like Southern California, Texas, down around all the southern coasts, you know, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio, go up the side, Virginia, you know, some of them, Pennsylvania. So you have these small towns that it's all military driven. But it's very rare that you see a lot from the, you know, the big cities, the urban areas. So it's definitely, as we always say, the heart of the country, the belt of the U.S.
This is generalization. They're not all infantry. They're all like in some support. There's a Jeep mechanics,
right, exactly,
group or
reserves.
Something.
You know, it's reserves, or, you know, a lot of them have come back and they go into like firefighting, or, you know, police, being working in the county police department or that kind of thing. So, but yeah, it's not a lot. There's a lot of reserves they come back and they still join. And I think that is because of that camaraderie. That's one of the areas of the military. And this is what I do know about the connection of the military and feeling as a purpose and having that camaraderie and that brotherhood and that support and having all that. And then once you're out, you're lost. If you don't find that same camaraderie or find a group or find some sort of support area, you're so lost. And that's where a lot of things start happening if you don't find that.
Well, the families are also, not all, but a lot of them are dispersed, and nobody's going to come from L.A. to visit their brother who lost a leg in Maywood.
I mean, exactly. Right.
It's unfortunate.
No, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of veterans that are at Heinz and their families live in L.A. And the one veteran told me, he goes, oh, I never hear from my son except when he wants money.
Yeah, well, it's... So. Dan, if I were to talk to Kenny tomorrow, what's the best day of the week for you to do something? Is Monday a good day?
Monday's always a good day. I usually have Monday as an office day.
All right. So. Well, take care. Maybe I'll see you pretty soon.
We can always... Yep, we will. All right. Thanks so much, Tom. John, have a good day.
Always a pleasure, Diane. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Jan, what do you think of that? I mean, you didn't talk enough, but what do you think of that?
It's overwhelming to think, this is the other side of the carpet. When you turn it over, you see what's really holding everything together. And, military engagements, that you get, all sorts of people behind them when there's, whooping up support for them. And then the long-term effect afterwards of, handling what's been caused by this and not really ever wanting to talk about it, except in occasions like this. It's the untold and unmeasured cost of war. And, the way the pain and suffering continues for generation after generation, and the reason for it, the thing that made people go into service in the first place is something you can kind of put back in some historical context. Hey, we did this because of that and how great that service was, but we don't really think how many people are still paying the price and will always pay it, and not just the ones who were injured and are hospitalized, but the family members who are trying to cope with it. And it's that kind of calculus that never gets talked about by politicians. Occasionally, Tammy Duckworth talks about veterans' issues because she herself is a veteran. But even then, it's a short-term addressing of something that requires some really deep study.
I'll bet you if she gives a speech like that in the Senate, there's nobody there. The only people watching are C-SPAN or something.
Even if they were there, what would they do? Or they'd be sleeping through it probably, or looking for the nearest opportunity to get the heck out of there. This has bothered me for a long time since I began to see people I knew, of my own age and family members who went into service and came back brutalized by the experience, and then I began to see it in my dad and his family and other people in that generation. And I kind of had an awakening maybe 40, 50 years ago that there's something really wrong.
Yeah,
the fighting the wars and the way they're fought and the way, we quickly cover up all of the horrors that we created and don't want to be reminded of, because there's another war brewing right around the corner that they're trying to drum up enthusiasm for. So who wants to hear about all these depressing stories from, the past 10, 20 years? You want to get that out of the picture completely, so it really infuriates me. And
what kind of a comedy would you say MASH was? It was a comedy that wasn't a comedy.
Yeah, it was black comedy.
Yeah,
and probably not even black enough, really.
Right.
It was nothing like the movie. When I compare the two, the movie was much more sinister. And
oh yeah.
They couldn't have put that into a long-running series on TV and had people watch it. So it tended to, focus on the slapstick and the silly stuff. And occasionally you'd get some wake-up call that, no, this is pretty
serious. Well, and the doctors were always heroes. You didn't see them pulling 15 bodies out in a show where nobody survived. I mean, it was...
Right. I thought as a comedy, it never could really work for, a long-term audience to stick with it. It's not... really what people were watching TV for.
But I would hope that
why you would make a comedy.
I would hope that even after several years running, for anybody that doesn't remember the show or whatever, they essentially was, for the first time, they had they called them a MASH unit. And in World War II, maybe there was a medic near you, maybe they could get you off the battlefield, but there was really, I mean, if you landed on D-Day, the first hospital bed was back in London, right, pretty much. But in Korea, they set up these, they call them MASH unit, where they mobile something, ambulatory. The idea is you bring somebody back from the front line, all wounded, you sew them back up so they survive, then you get them on a plane or boat to London or wherever you were going. Obviously, Korea, you weren't going to London, but it was like a first stop was a triage unit, basically, which you really didn't have in World War II, I don't think. I mean, you had some, military tents and so forth, but that's what it was totally set up to be. And they were right by the front lines, right? I mean, that was a huge innovation. Well, the innovation was an awful lot of more people survived. But just because you lopped your leg off and you survived and didn't die on the field doesn't mean you're now wandering around without a leg. Well then it presupposes some sort of an artificial limb. It presupposes care. It presupposes all kinds of stuff that, I don't think anybody was ready for. Wait a minute, these guys used to be dead. Now they're not. Now what do we do with them, type of thing. This has been a progression in care, and every time you make a step forward, John, there's always three steps to the side, right? And virtually in everything, no matter what it is, right? I mean, so now, look at the amount of people in Afghanistan that are double amputees and those kinds of things. Well, you didn't have many of those World War II. They died on the battlefield, right?
Yeah, there were no survivors from that kind of stuff.
I mean, if you landed on an island in the South Pacific and you got blown up like that, maybe somebody happened to be near a medic and they got you back to a ship, but what are the chances? Right? I mean, you didn't set up a MASH unit on the beach the second you landed. Like, now you probably would, right? Or you have plus, they didn't have any helicopters, right? So you couldn't get anybody anywhere. I mean, one of the things...
My dad was at the Battle of Bulge in World War II, and was wounded on Christmas Day 44 at Bastogne, near Bastogne. And he was in a foxhole with two other guys, and, there was a shell that hit, and he survived, of course, but he had to listen to the two other guys in the foxhole die very slowly and painfully. And he was treated in a makeshift hospital. It was freezing cold, below zero, snow everywhere. The physician, he said, he was pretty out of it at the time, but the guy had never really done any kind of surgery at all. He had just been kind of landed in, and they had this temporary facility. And he saved my dad's
fresh out of med school. Here you are.
Yeah, this was extremely improvised, and the whole Battle of the Bulge incursion was improvised. I mean, it happened very suddenly, where they started flying in people from everywhere. My dad was, in England having glider training, perfectly happy there, and all of a sudden, boom! 48 hours later, they were landing at night in Belgium, and all hell's breaking loose. But he would not talk about really the experience very much, except when he was in a very thoughtful mood. He was extremely scarred by it, and what we would call PTSD resulting from it, as did my uncle, his brother, who saw even more action than my dad, and was at Normandy and Sicily, North Africa. I mean, he was in for a long time, tons of stories, but he refused to say, talk about any of it. And the bottling up of those experiences has its own reasons for hospitalization later on.
Absolutely.
They were both pretty sound people when they came back from war, but they were mentally damaged. And nobody expected them to not be able to hold a job because of it, and they did.
Fine. Well, even the simple stuff in MASH, when radar had the great hearing, he'd hear the choppers. World War II, there weren't any choppers. You couldn't get evacuated by helicopter.
No airlifting.
None of that stuff.
No, but what's really kind of and the thing about MASH, just to kind of put a cap on that was set in Korea, which has kind of the notoriety or the infamy of being a war nobody wants to talk about anymore at all. And there's far greater, you know.
I never met anybody. I mean, obviously, John, you and I were, we'll say this, the wrong age. Our parents and our uncles and those people, some were, they were part of, everybody was part of the World War II experience. Either you went, like, the house side of the family, and, well, my uncle got killed, and my dad ended up with melanoma so bad that he ended up dying from that. So I guess that's two for two on that side. Now, my Italian side of the family, those guys were all tool and die makers or something, and they couldn't go. They had to stay here, and they were part of the war effort here. I mean, if they, for those that don't, well, when I say recall, there was a massive fight almost between the army that wanted to go to like a 6 million person army, and the people here saying, well, that's fine, but if you want tanks for 6 million people, you better leave a few guys here or we can't produce them. So on the one side, those guys were all skilled, and my uncle, my oldest uncle, went to Hawaii, I believe, as a ship repair guy, but he was never, I think he worked for a civilian firm, so he was never able to get the GI Bill or any other stuff. And there was, between my stepfather and my uncles, there was always this little bit of tension, even though they were friends, that he came back and ended up getting his accounting degree at DePaul and went on and have a, you know, a real nice career as an executive, where my uncles basically remained welders. And one guy got into printing press construction. He did real well, but they were like, wait a minute, the people here got nothing. You know, and the ladies who were in the wax and the waves and something, they got nothing. So it was pretty, and the black people, especially from the South, now some of the people, if you were from the North, and you were in the Tuskegee Airmen, you actually could go to school because they'd let you in. Well, in the South, okay, you got free tuition, but you're sure as hell not getting into Alabama, are you?
No.
And so, I mean, it was very uneven how this was all taken care of, but now we have people that are surviving, we have families that are disparate, and you have people like Diane that do a lot of this stuff. And I was stunned when my stepfather was in Manteno, how many people from the area constantly were there one or two nights a week. As these guys get that old, they serve them dinner, they can't cut their hamburger, right? So there's people there to show up a couple nights a week and help people eat. I mean, this gets very basic. I mean, in these smaller areas, these smaller towns, I'm not saying nobody in... Obviously, we've got somebody who's just on the show that donates a lot of her time, so it's not like nobody here does that stuff, but it becomes almost like a way of life in some of these other areas. You know, people are there. There's guys that once a month will take the guys that are able to the Sox game in a big van. And I would never even think of doing that. I mean, there's guys here that go and play music. It's not all about us sometimes, man. It's a... Hey, let's shift gears for a few minutes before Nancy calls in. What are you making of Market?
Well.
How's that page two? How much?
How high is high, Kyle?
I was kind of stunned this weekend in that I went to my local bar, and the usual glass of wine I get was up $2. And I went to Meijer's yesterday, and I saw, like, nothing on sale. Gasoline, not going anywhere. But I'm starting to see this momentum here on just about everything starting up again. And I've been reporting, I know the only person left in the wilderness that talks about money supply, except for maybe Hal. Carl does some too. We're pumping along. We are absolutely pushing asset prices higher, stock prices higher for the people who have it, and we're leaving everybody else in the dirt. Now the question is how... It's not like regular people. I have a boatload of clients that are just regular people. They have their 401ks that have somehow kept pace because they are being in the right stocks. Some people aren't in the right stocks. They're not doing so hot, but there's nothing we can do about that. They're legacy stocks, and to a certain extent, we protect them for people. Well, not to a certain extent, to a large extent. But it's still, nobody wants a stock that's down $100. You know, if we do our job right and you only lose 20, I guess we're stalwarts, but it's still not up, is it? I mean, it's better than it was, but I mean, and it's very difficult to do, and we're proud of the fact when we do that, but it's still not the same as winning, is it? I mean, yet some stocks, they're overwhelming the averages. You know, they're overwhelming everything, and I don't, without even though I've never been a fan, I would like my president to win. I think the Z and this guy from NVIDIA are treating him like a stumble bump, Jan. Or am I wrong there? I mean, something's weird. I mean, whatever it is with this, I mean, Kevin sent out the stuff last week regarding, you know, Trump says they can't have the best chips. And then somebody turns around and rents some space on the chips here. Well, where is your read? I mean, I know you listen in. What's your read on the role or the U.S., even if they're not a U.S. registered company? Do they have any loyalty at all? I think they think they don't. But what do you think?
I wouldn't think, if you asked them if they have any loyalty, if they were honest, they would say absolutely not. And I think that's what you have to presume, really.
I do too. But now, how do you handle that?
Well, you kind of recognize the risks involved in national security issues getting too chummy with places that, you know, take such a dismal view of loyalty to one side or the other, or even to recognize that there are different sides to begin with. And that's kind of been the key to success for a lot of corporations, is pretending that, you know, nobody is an enemy, everybody is an ally, because we're all making money, and that's all we're all here to do anyway. And the geopolitical stuff, you know, the long-term objectives for, you know, dominance in the, you know, military or territory or whatever, that doesn't interest them at all, and they prefer not to even have to worry about it. So, you know, I'm most worried about right now is with the stock market booming this way, I don't see that translating to any kind of a jobs explosion or the jobs creation kind of trend. In fact, quite the opposite. So I don't think anybody's really prepared for the kind of thud that's going to occur when there are mass layoffs, because nobody needs people to do what we've gotten so good at creating technologies to replace people with. And that this is something that I think is probably behind a lot of the wealth that's being created. It's really kind of, you know, boosted or held up by the fact that people are going to be pretty dispensable. They're already dispensable in a lot of areas, but we ain't seen nothing yet.
Well, so, I think there's a lot of stuff that people can do and should be doing that aren't.
Our housing
stack is needs massive degrees of upgrade. Our buildings do. There's all kinds of stuff for people to do.
Of course, yeah, but, you know, what are they going to, what kind of houses will those people build, Tom? They're not going to be the kind of houses that people can afford. There won't be enough people.
No, what I'm saying is it's not like there's no real jobs around. I just wonder, Jan, when we elect people, and I'm not just talking about this guy. I wonder if I always use the example of way back in the day when Bush was president. You know, and I don't think Bush was a bad guy. I really question, and you've been kind of with me on this, and our guys Wayne and Andrew, you know, where that all came from, to where the grandfather and who was he involved with? Was it the Russians or the
Germans?
The Germans, Prescott. And you wonder how this, all this power comes working its way through, but leaving that alone at the side, I can't imagine George Jr. sitting in a room with the heads of the five oil companies, and they got to be wondering, what is this guy doing sitting over there?
I mean, it's like Hunter Biden.
Yeah, it's basically, and now I can't, when you get the heads of these big corporations and stuff together with Trump, and all they know is he wants adulation and a sideshow of cash. I can't imagine that what even goes on there. There was as much as some people, you know, the fact that Kennedy was philandering and doing all kinds of stuff, there was a guy who put together all his tapes, and somehow or another, I listened to a couple of them, and I don't know where the hell they are now. They taped the White House even then, and nobody, this guy went through like all of them, and he goes, it was absolutely incredible that no matter who was in the room, no matter what business it was obvious 10 minutes into the conversation that Kennedy knew as much about their business as they did, that he did that much preparation before every meeting. Even though he was running around banging girls in the White House, somehow or another he did it all the same day. I guess you got to hand it to him or whatever, but they said the man was drop-dead brilliant, and nobody could put one over on him. no matter what the industry was. When have we had anybody like that since? I'm not saying he was perfect or anything like that. He had all kinds of warts, but I mean, can you imagine a room with this guy and sitting there with Zuckerberg and the head of NVIDIA and so forth? They got to wonder who they're in the room with. And it, probably the same thing it was you or me. It's not like I'm saying, where do we find somebody who's that kind of an equal that somehow gets elected when that nobody cares about that? It's all short-term stuff. It's all tweets. Well, now it's tweets. It used to be, you know, one or two campaign slogans. And how do we get ourselves an equal to these people? I don't know how we, I don't, mentally, I don't see how, well, we can.
You know, the political, you know, class from, you know, which we drop presidents or executives, it clearly doesn't have what somebody would need on their own to be qualified to go into a room full of experts, you know, who have lived and breathed whatever the subject happens to be that day in whatever technological level. There's no person not part of that class already, and that's, you take just one industry and that leave off the other industries, there's nobody who's going to be electable to office who has that kind of skill set. And even JFK didn't, you know, by all, you know, indications, he was a so-so student. He read, but he read kind of, you know, popular history pretty much, but he was surrounded by extremely bright people who knew their value to him, and he depended on them, and they were often in the room with him. So I mean, he wanted to get smart about it, but he even more importantly, you know, wanted to surround himself with people who were smarter than he was about whatever the subject was. And he might have to make the ultimate decision, but he did it based on, you know, some fairly sophisticated input by people who knew this better than he did. And I think the Trump second administration is in that same mold. He's got some, you know, smart people he didn't have access to the first time around. I don't think that the insiders would let him get near some of the people that he wanted to get. He settled for people who were clearly not even on his team, and were working actively against him. That's different now, and that's going to be the case now from here to the end of time, Tom. As long as we have a republic, well, but you're not going to have politicians who know diddly squat about 90% of what they have to talk to behind closed doors.
It's about recognizing.
And it's the same with Xi Jinping and Macron and Star. I mean, there isn't a single executive I can point to who's any better than Trump in any of this stuff. But they're surrounded by people, for good or bad, who think they know.
It's about knowing what you don't know, and the bigger ego you have, the more you think you know everything.
Right, and you know, Bush unfortunately didn't have all that many smart people around him, if you consider Rumsfeld and Cheney for starters. And we made some horrible decisions.
They were very smart, but they were closeted in their way of thinking.
We needed smart people at the time, though. You know, so there's been failings. You know, we've often had bad advice given to the presidents who thought they were getting great advice and, you know, and had to act as if they were getting great advice. So I don't see that ever changing.
Well, who was the buffoon? What was the name of the guy who, we got to get to a break here and then we'll get Dan. Who was the guy that totally befuddled Rumsfeld to the point where they were paying him as a consultant? They thought they were going to land him in Iraq and he was going to be the new president. And the minute they landed, they almost wanted to lynch the guy and ran him out of the country.
Oh, L. Paul Bremer?
Yeah, what the hell? What was that all about?
Well, that's kind of like what you know, the position Tony Blair is in with being the Gaza expert. You know, I don't think that's going to go over very well ultimately. Okay. But there's always been, you know, attempts to groom people who they're no better at any of these tasks that are being dreamed up for them than the person living next door to me. But they've been handpicked. And they've got an agenda, and you know, this is kind of why Penny Pritzker is involved in rebuilding Ukraine. Does she really? I mean, maybe she has Ukrainian roots, but does she know very much about it? I don't know.
Well, I mean,
she's going to act as if she knows everything. So,
well, there's knowledge around if you go to get it. Like Bill Moriarty says, if you want to build a dam, there's people around the world building dams. You just got to find them and get the right people. But it's
From here on, Tom, you know, if there's Zuckerberg, or Bezos, or you know, you name it, whatever the tech whiz of the moment has to be, you know, and how you're going to go in and talk turkey to them, let alone to some other, you know, foreign head of state. You're going to be surrounded by people that we hope have been chosen for skills.
I always wonder if they're just yes people. Hey, what do you say we go to break and then we'll We'll bring Nancy on. We haven't talked to her in a couple
weeks. I'm on.
We're going to do a quick break, Nancy. Not much going on here, but we got to do a little something. SP Futures up 18. NASDAQ Futures up 156. We'll be right back. Jimmy, let's do this quick.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
We're back.
Well, welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Jim Lawler on the board. Real quick, SP Futures up 19. NASDAQ Futures up 160 as we continue to move up here. And, again, everybody obviously knows that I want the market to go up for my people and for me. But I also know that when so much of the wealth is in stuff that just goes up versus what people are making, it's long term, it's kind of it can be somewhat not the best. Nance, what's going on? How are you?
I'm good, guys. How are you?
Fine. Why didn't you drop by on Saturday? I know. Because we ended up with some massive pizza, and we couldn't go out because we couldn't shut the front door, because Audrey got the front door painted, and we let it dry, so we couldn't very well leave the door open and leave.
Well, wait a minute. Are you telling me you had a party on Saturday?
It wasn't really a party. We just couldn't go out, and I went out and got a pizza with the salad and all kinds of stuff. It was really good. It wasn't a party. We couldn't leave for fear that the poodle and the Maltese might escape.
You're kidding.
Well, we couldn't close the front door.
No offense, but that's hilarious.
Well, I mean, you know, you got to wait till the paint dries. And I had some guys over, and they were scurrying around doing all kinds of stuff in preparation of winter, caulking, and I'm running back and forth to the store, you know, doing what I do, you know, buy caulk, I buy screws, whatever they need, I go get, you know. I'm like, you know. I know enough about the construction to always find the right stuff type of thing.
Well, why aren't you guys at my house helping? I'm in the same boat with one arm.
We got guys, if you want the guys.
Okay.
Anyway, what's going on? What's going on in your world? You hear it? You listening to the Diane stuff early? It was pretty good.
No, I didn't hear Diane. What's going on with her?
We're trying to piece together sort of like a Veterans Week or two, and Jan's my man here, so we're going to have... We set her up with Kenny Polcari to talk about the fundraising they're doing out in New York to try and inject the veterans' homes with some money to do more psychological stuff instead of in addition to the physical stuff. And we're going to try and put that all together and combine it. So, and Diane, as you well know, Diane is fine. Terrific. So,
yeah, she is. I agree with you guys 100%.
And then, And I'm anxious to see what they plan on doing with this thing from Kenny, Jan, because, and then also I'd like to do my usual cost accounting approach on things, talk to our friend Dr. Mark, what exactly do you need? Do you need a visit from a psychologist every week, every month? How many people are there? I mean, what's the budget for something like this, even in a place? And try and work it up a little bit, Jan, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, is he going to be on tomorrow?
He's going to come on with Wednesday with Kevin.
Okay, I'll be listening.
And I'm sure we'll probably walk our way into Notre Dame basketball a little bit with Dr. Blade. So we can't stop that, because Blade was a terrific basketball player, and in addition to being a good psychologist. But, you know, Nance, he's from the old school of psychology, to where if you have a problem, you work with him, you work your way through it. And I think one of the reasons why he retired is that the new mantra is give somebody a drug and send them on their way. So we'll get a different view. I don't think you can just tell somebody, who's a veteran and saw people get blown up, I don't think you just give them a drug and send them on their way. So I think there's
being absolutely not. I agree.
There's got to be more hands-on on that. And I don't know. He used to tell me stories about what's the phobia you can't eat in restaurants, Jen? Whatever that one is, and Mark would take somebody and they'd find a place that opens at like noon, and they'd be there right at 5 to 12. So he and the guy or the lady would walk in, they'd sit at a table right by the door and right by the window, and gradually you'd work it to where you'd work the phobia down instead of just giving them a drug and say go in there stoned. Don't the airlines still do that at the airports? If you're afraid to fly, you go in and they tour you around the plane, and you get to sit in the plane on the ground and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's some whole acclimation routine. Yeah,
they still do that.
It seems like I'd be surprised if they did, given the quality of the experience flying these days.
God. So anyway, that's we're gonna try and put that together this week, Nance, and see how we do it. And if it gets real good, we might send it off somewhere to Twitter or something. Not Twitter, but YouTube or something. Kind of combine all of them. So there.
That's good. I hit a domestic violence next door, and the girl was shot, came here. I let her in, and believe me, this standoff with these gun shooting went on for, maybe an hour and a half.
It wasn't just domestic. He had a gun pointing at you.
Yeah, I know. It really got out of control, but getting to the PTSD part of it, I mean, like a couple days later I was like, oh God. I mean, you just all of a sudden, when the whole thing was over, I'd been up all night. That CSI, I never dreamt that was really real. It is real. They come to your house, they take everything, and they just make you sit outside. And the next day I had to go to work because I had loans that had to get closed. And so I'm there and I'm wide awake. I'm there, I'm dead tired. And all you can think about is how many lives could have been lost. It's unbelievable. And I remember the detective standing over me and said, do you realize you saved her life? And I said, there's no joy in this. There's no joy in this story.
Nancy just did what you were supposed to do, like you always do. And at the end of the day, just for a quick cliff notes, this guy was he was whacking his girlfriend with a gun. He went to shoot her, and the gun jammed, right?
So he was shooting. He shot all over, but the gun jammed. Then he beat her, pistol whipped her with it.
Yeah, he jammed before he got a chance to shoot her.
Yeah, in other words, he had right at her to shoot, and it jammed because it was Walmart. They said it because he bought his tickets, bullets at Walmart. And I was like, oh, great, what an advertisement. And the bottom line is you don't think you're affected, but you are for days. I just walked around like, wow.
Well, she came over and got in your place, but by now he had got the gun unjammed. And
shooting. Yeah, then he started shooting at my house. Yep.
Jen, this was a big deal, a real big deal.
God.
The only person that sort of lucked out was the young lady who didn't get shot in the head because at that particular moment it jammed.
Correct. Absolutely correct. But the story is really about how you deal with PTSD, because it was my first. I never really understood it, but once you're in it, oh my God, it's a whole different ballgame than what you think. I mean, PTSD is a real thing. It's a very real thing for what those guys saw. Because once you see it, you can't unsee it.
And if it was like a month or years long thing, I can't even imagine how it stacks up. You can't.
Could you imagine doing it repeatedly and repeatedly every day? No.
I bet you repress it to such a point, and then one day it just comes out.
Yeah, I really feel for these men. I really, really feel for these men, because I don't think it's a easy. It's something you're not going to forget. So I don't think giving them a pill helps anything. I think they have to talk it out.
And everybody else is convinced it's no problem. They would have no problem with it, which is total BS.
Right. In fact, my house is alarmed, and I went to turn on the silent alarm. Couldn't remember how to do it.
Oh, God.
And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. But there's so much going on so fast to save a life. you know, you, that's what you're concerned with. And so can you I just can't imagine what these guys have to go through with trying to save the guy next to him. And you know what I mean? It's just not a good, I mean, a pill. What I'm trying to say is a pill is not an answer. I believe that they need much, much more than that.
Now, Nance, if you had some big old pit bulls instead of your little foo-foo dogs.
Hey, my little foo-foo dogs came to the rescue because when I got her on the ground and I got her head packed and I got ice on her and I was talking to the police, she was screaming and the dogs went and laid on her.
Well, that's...
And she stopped. And so, thank God, because they said he's going to figure out where we're at. Right now, he's not real sure where you're at. He's shooting here because it's convenient, but, I mean, no response coming out of the house is what he wants. And so, I mean, the foo-foo dogs really helped because they were licking her and stuff, and she's like, they're licking me. You know, got her head completely off of the fact she was bleeding out.
Good.
Well, how long ago did this happen, Nancy?
I think about in 2019, maybe.
It was right before COVID, I think.
It was during COVID because I remember that one of the people said, you don't have your COVID mask on. I'm like, oh, God, I don't go in the house. I can't go in the house. And, you know, of course, I didn't have my COVID mask on when I was in the house. I was actually in bed when the whole thing started. Sorry.
Well, the police were pretty good when they got there, right?
Oh, God, they saved the day. I mean, because, like, I got the kid at the door. He said, we have to understand what's going on because the shooting was started next door, right? And then he was standing there and he goes, this is my first day back on the job. And he started shooting at him. So all you keep seeing on the cameras is my hand going out and grabbing people off the porch in the house and slamming the door shut.
Well, I didn't know they shot at the cops.
Oh, yeah. And then the cop was like, I'm under fire. And they're like, this is your first day back on the job. You just had a kidney transplant. And I'm like, hey, guys, we need help here.
Nancy, how many cases of PTSD grew out of that episode, including your own case?
I have no idea, but there were. And then, to make matters worse, I had taken a concealed carry class. And so I have my concealed carry license, but I don't own a gun. So they're at the... Now the cops are at my back door. And they're like, let us in, because I've got the cop. I've got her. And I'm like... So I said, you got to stand somewhere where I can see you, you know? And so they're cops. Okay, so I let them in. And I got my hands up, and I said, just so you know, I got a concealed carry license, but I don't have a gun. I never follow through. And they're like, okay, that's fine. And they said, thank God you told us, because we thought you were the shooter. And I'm like, no, I'm not the shooter.
Yeah, so did you actually get your license or just go through the class?
No, I actually got the license.
See, I went through the class. I never got the license. When I figured out you can't take it anywhere, what's the point?
Well, I know you do figure that out during the class, and that was kind of where I was at, but the class was they signed you up before you left.
Ah.
So that was it. And then the, his part, you know, they did get to another guy here, but he's like, I'm taking fire. And she's got the other cop inside the house. And I'm like,
Where'd they find him? Out in the woods somewhere?
He was out in the woods. In all the chaos that went on, because this went on for an hour before SWAT showed up, and I kept saying, we got to get her out of here because she's bleeding too much. And but they didn't know where he was, so he was in the forest reserve, but he did come back when SWAT arrived and took her out, and SWAT carried her out a block away to get an ambulance, and they had fire trucks blocking the streets on both ends.
Wow.
And then when they got her out, SWAT really took over, and they found him he was in his attic.
Good Lord.
So,
see, this is people, peaceful suburbia, John, just saying.
Yeah, John, that's why I didn't wind up at the MASH. No.
God.
The MASH was just a really cold day, and it seems that my shoulder does not like damp. It's not the cold, it was the damp. Was driving it insane. But anyways, so PTSD affects a lot of people. And you guys can remember, this was just one day in my life.
Yeah. Well,
and now you got veterans who spent years doing this. Can you? I mean, and they say, well, I don't understand why they don't want to talk about it. Well, I can.
Yeah, it's all it takes is a little bit of brush. You understand But you got to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes for a while. All right, Nance, what's going on in the mortgage world? And what's going on, John, what's going on downtown? Another couple of buildings. By the way, the CBOE allegedly, the guys flipped that to somebody else and made a bunch of dough.
Yeah, I just saw that. I don't know who the buyer is.
Somebody rich.
Well, CBOE, you know, when all of a sudden, you know, some of the guys are probably listening, but well, you don't have to do anything anymore except charge people for quotes and you stop doing what you're supposed to be doing. All of a sudden, money's too easy, right? Was it money for nothing and the chicks for free? Isn't that what is the difference in money between the people now that really have it? I was just walking around yesterday doing some shopping and everything. Money is like worth nothing. I mean, if you got $100 in your pocket, you can't get through two aisles in the food store without blowing through $100. It's like nothing. It's nothing if you're going to buy a car. It's nothing. You got your car repaired. I mean, you think you got a bunch of hundreds in your pocket, you're rich. You're not nothing. You're nothing. Oh. Or am I missing something here?
No, I would say you're right. I mean, I just bought lunch meat and, I bought lunch meat and just some salads, and it was $75.
Yeah.
It was all in one little bag that I could carry, not much.
I got sent to the Home Depot to buy two little packages of screws for, Audrey wanted some more gutters attached, so Salvador was doing that for us, and $22 for two little packages of screws. 10 years ago, they'd be $2 a package. That kind of stuff is just outstanding. So, Jan, ask what you want. What are the mortgage rates? You got any biz? What's going on, Nance?
I've got business, guys. It's but the market, everybody says I got a lot of calls yesterday. Well, the rates went down. Well, the market had already built in for that quarter going down. So I would say that rates are solid in the sixes. Other than that, I mean, they were more heavily in the sevens. Most likely you were going to get a 7% rate, but now they're definitely in the sixes. New home buyers can get like 6.49. You're just not seeing it yet where it's down to the 6.6 level. If you want to buy it down a point, you can probably get a point and a half, you can probably get 5.99.
When is the rest of society, if ever, going to realize that there can be zero connection between the Fed lowering short-term rates and long-term rates? It actually could go the other way. The 10-year rate is the exact same place as when they started cutting rates. Was it?
I understand that. That's what makes it so difficult for people to understand, Tom. I mean, they just look at you and they say, well, they cut the rates. Yes, they did cut the rates, but you got to really look at that 10-year bond. And typically, the old rule of thumb was if the stock market was doing well, then the bond market was doing poorly because it was suppressed because all the money was in the stock market. So the bonds were lowered and then the interest rate would be lowered. This is like how the longest time in history I've ever seen them not working in that sequence.
Well, they haven't worked in that sequence kind of for a long time since the Fed started monkeying with the bond market.
Correct. So that is not there either. But who are they getting their advice from? Their appearance. And that was the rule of thumb you could go by.
Well, the
Betsy, what would you say the split is in your client base between, renters? Not they're currently renters. They're going to be buyers. I mean, first time buyers, or after having had a spell of renting, versus people who are doing. Selling an existing home and applying for a loan for a new one. And has the sort of split between those people shifted in any way in the last 10 years?
I'm getting mainly renters right now. Mm-hmm. Before you would just get one buyer selling and someone who sold buying. I'm getting renters saying my rent is going up to like $3,000 a month, $2,800 a month. What can I get for that? And usually if you're that high, you should be able to get a mortgage without a problem and be able to buy something with only 3% down. I mean, let's get real. Let's add in that it's only 3% down. So at $300,000, that's $9,000.
So they're pretty motivated buyers, and they're getting scalded by their rents. Yeah.
Correct. It's the rents that are driving the business back up, but the inventory isn't there. And then if it is there and you get a buyer, you know, these people renting, they figure, well, I could just find another one if I don't do this one. Because we, I know I've got, you know, some, including Audrey, she's telling them, look, this isn't going to last. You got to put a bid in. You got to look at it now. And either they're saying, well, I can look at it this weekend, or I'm not, you know, I'm not available, or I got to think about it some more. And they're all lost. By 2 days later, they call back and say, okay, I want to do it. It's gone.
Wow.
It's gone already. Because everybody realizes that the rents are only going to go up.
Well, everything seems like it's going to be going up. That's what. How do you match that up with, Jen? What did we talk about last time Nance was on? Is it over 50% of the deals now are cash deals? And a lot of Audrey's deals now are cash deals.
Yeah, a lot of them are cash deals. You know, a lot of them are in the usually. I mean, that's the richer pot than, you know, the average. That's not the average Joe, but. The people like that are coming in the country, like from doctors from India, those types of things. They are selling their what they have in Europe, and they're coming here, so they have cash. And in Europe, they don't have 30-year loans, guys. So I mean, these people are more used to buying in cash, anyways.
How do we get back down to? Not that I'm criticizing. How do we get back down to 3% mortgages, which everybody says was caused 2007 crash, which it didn't, by the way, but how do we get back down to 3%?
I think the Feds bought the bonds. Feds bought up the market during COVID, you know, during COVID, and had it low to keep things going.
All right.
That, in my opinion, but I am in no means an expert.
Well, do you think these, if you look at the numbers, now, of course, if I discuss this with Audrey, I'm always wrong, but you look at the numbers, the housing prices versus people's income, it's 40% worse than 2007. What am I missing?
The rules just got more lax, that's all, Tom.
But I mean, in terms of people's vulnerability, they're right back where we were in 2007.
You know, that's hard to say, because I mean, we're all if you lose your job, okay, you immediately become vulnerable, okay? But what are we supposed to do? Like, somebody said to me yesterday, guy was complaining about his car insurance, and I said, did you look at your house insurance? Because that's really going to go up. And he said, oh, it's blamed on the economy and the administration. And I said, to be really honest with you, it's blamed on the fact that Illinois has had so many claims, and we've had such odd weather. I'm just saying, for Illinois, we have had odd weather, especially in Chicagoland area with the hailstorms and the severity of the storms when they come. And I said, it has caused so many hail claims on cars, hail damage. That's why, and they've had to pay out. So I said, that's really what's caused it. And now I know for sure that, I know it's a fact that State Farm, so let's say your house gets damaged on the east side, but on the north, south, and west side, it's good, right? They're only replacing the east side with the aluminum siding. That's it. That's what they're going to replace.
Well, I know, and some of these, when I heard people get roofs, roofs for $90,000, I know you could have knocked me over with a feather. I thought roofs were like
five
grand.
I'm saying, and the roofs are the same thing. Our roofs are going to arbitration for some companies in Illinois, and because they're willing to replace a part of the roof, part that was damaged, but they're not really willing to replace the whole thing, those are going to become special endorsements. So this fighting about, you know, where it came from and all of that, that's going to kind of stop. You either have the special endorsement policy or you don't. So I asked at my little educational seminars, okay, how much more is that going to cost? Because I'm going to for sure mention it to people. And they said probably, like, you know, it'll affect your policy maybe $80 a year.
Nance, has there been any, you and I and Jen, I don't know if you guys remember this, was like last year, maybe early in the year, when they had the fires out in California and they had the, you know, the mess in Florida. one of the things we talked about, maybe because Carl signed us onto it, was the codes in all those places have been changing. And all, well, like say in California regarding fires and so forth, the codes have been changing in what you need for your roof and fire retardation, all those kinds of things. And people are always kind of grandfathered in. Well, now that they're burned down, you can't build the house the way it was. You got to build it, I'll say, stouter. Now, and
right.
you were the one that said, well, the check for the old house is not going to equal what it costs to build the new house. Has any of this, since we now have had these hailstorms, which I don't ever remember them causing damage anymore when I was younger, and once in a while you got bonked on the head, but it wasn't that big of a deal, has it caused a change in any of the roofing codes or any places in Orland and Tinley and the places that got hit like that or not?
I don't, you know what? I'm not sure about that, but I do know that because I have been asking lots of questions about this because it affects my borrower. I want them to succeed. And the guy said that we tell them now that this shingle will last this long, but I said, do you actually say to them what's going to happen if there's a hailstorm? Because it's imperative they understand that. And he said they have to go with this heavier weight shingle for it to last. So he went up on my roof and he said, you have the heavyweight shingle. And I said, that's because I got tired of fiddling around with roof problems. I mean, I just gave in and said, all right, I'm just going to do it right, and that's it. But doing it right for me at the time might have been $14,000. And you got to remember, that's just the average that's just the cheapest price now for
roof. Well, that's it. Because Audrey had the cedar shake that got damaged, and the one she has now, they'll be able to take the hailstorm she had, but if it comes out to be like grapefruit size, there's a size at which no roof can take. I mean, right?
Well, you know what? Like the guy said, you have one little spot that really, he said when I'm up next door doing the roof there, he said I will put some of this. They also have some kind of clear coat now that could help. And then, he said we're going to just, he said you've got one small area. He said maybe 2 feet by 2 feet. I mean, so he said that way your whole roof is still holding. He said heavier shingle works. So I think people have to, I didn't know the difference when I bought my roof. It was my husband who said, wait a minute now, we've done this a little bit too often. And the guy said, well, the only way you can really stop it is to get to a heavier shingle, which I did. And I got a warranty with it. And the guy told me I'm the first one that's ever used the warranty.
Well, when I talk about the numbers I was saying earlier, and you know this better than anybody, I calculated, and Jen was at a sit through this a couple of weeks ago, I went through the cost of home ownership versus 2000. And I looked at the prices. Mortgage rates are about the same as they were in 2000. Those have come back. I looked at the insurance, and I looked at the other taxes.
You are correct about the mortgage rates in 2000. They were just getting into the sevens at that point.
So we have it roughly equal. According to the CPI, I think it's where we should be up 80. A dollar is now worth 180. So prices are up 80% according to the CPI. I've got total cost of home ownership. In the CPI, I think it's up it's a little over doubled. I've got it damn near tripling since 2000, cost of home ownership. You take it all down the line.
I believe it.
Taxes got to be up like 285%. Insurance is up like 275, and the housing prices are up. Back then I think they were 160, and now they're 410. So they're more than double, 2.5 times. So if you look at this, and I don't see anybody's. Let's be nice and say it's 275. It's up. What are income is not, is it even double, Jen? I don't even think it's even double.
No, I don't think it's double. Can't double.
Yeah, income's up 80%. The housing prices are up almost 300%. I mean, we're not even on the same page. I mean, when you say where do I get my numbers? They're right there, for God's sake.
Right. No, Tom. This is
I mean, I remember my grandparents, my grandfather saying, oh, my grandkids, what's going to happen to my grandkids, right? And now I hear my brother starting to echo that, and I said, oh my gosh, I just sound like grandpa, you know, but we all get so used to it, it's no big deal.
Well, I mean, if that's why I'm so worried about the market, not just for my clients, because we got a dash here, but it's like the one leg left in the stool that's holding things up. I mean, if people lose their 401k wealth and housing prices drop 15%, we got a real problem.
Correct. That is correct.
And I'm not serious. And as these things go up every day, I like them going up. But I sit there and go, how many days in a row can NVIDIA go up $125 billion market cap? I mean, at some point, I mean, who's going to have the money to pay those prices so the thing's worth what it is? I mean, I hope they're all right. But anyway, so you guys you missed your chance last Saturday, but we'll get you guys together.
Yeah, I think we should just make a date where I know we're going to go indoors, and then I don't have the same problem.
Well, everybody
can always come over to my house and get shot. I mean, you know,
well, that's true.
That hasn't happened in a while, so maybe we could have a.
Well, you might have gone inside anyway because we got attacked. The workers got attacked by bees with all the apple juice out there.
Did they really?
Oh yeah.
The bees won the day.
The bees won the day.
So, but I didn't know that.
John and I sat in the garage a little away from the fray.
Yeah, we kept shooting them away. They didn't want any part of us.
So they go, how come you didn't help? And I said, did you ever see the movie Ben-Hur? And they go, what's that got to do with anything? But when the guy's he's rowing in the galley, and whenever somebody died rowing, they throw him out and put a new guy in. I said, nobody died. If anybody would have fallen out, we'd have jumped in, but everybody hung in there. I don't think that's what they wanted to hear, Nance, but, you know. Anyway, SP Futures up 27. The NASDAQ Futures up 226. You got to watch these old movies for these things, you know. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Thanks.
Love it.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east, to the master bedroom where the vampires feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abodes to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun. The guest included Wolfman, Dracula, and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash. Out from his coffin, Rex's voice did ring. Seemed he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
The monster mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's caught on in a flash.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. Now everything's cool. Drax a part of the band. And my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them Boris sent you.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And do my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can monster mash.
Mash! Easy, Igor. You
Monster Mash. Mash good. Monster Mash.